A Story Publishing presents Veiled Compass, Prologue. Rain had chased the daylight out of England, leaving Oxford's limestone black, slick, and gleaming. From the height of the Radcliffe camera, a gull could have traced every halo of street lamp, every hurried scholar, every locked door that would soon remember a key. It was Friday, 12th of October 2023, 7 minutes before midnight. An hour the university preferred to forget existed, though tonight, five lives moved through it in parallel, unknowingly steering toward the same fracture line. Near Christchurch Meadow, Dr. Eleanor Thorne rehearsed tomorrow's lecture aloud while pedaling her bicycle through the drizzle, a thin file of notes slapped restlessly against the inside of her satchel. Nora loved history the way spelunkers love dark water, exhilaration and claustrophobia braided together, but recent tenure reviews had sharpened her speech into something almost combative. "Determinism," she muttered, breath fogging, "doesn't care whether you agree with it." She rang her bell at a sleep-drunk pedestrian, missed the puddle she was aiming for, and sped on toward the weak glow of Cowley Road. Across the Atlantic, in a Cambridge makerspace painted the color of insomnia, Amira Shah leaned over two monitors. Cobalt-tipped hair curtained her eyes as lines of code scrolled, hunting the phrase "veiled compass" through archives that were never meant to be searchable. Midnight here would come 5 hours later, but Amira was already fueled by sour candy and righteous curiosity. Every ping of a new match tightened the knot in her stomach. Fragments of naval telegrams, an NSA budget line blacked out to the margins, an Edwardian ledger sold last year at auction. "Who are you people?" she whispered, fingers drumming a plastic desk cluttered with anti-static wrist straps and half-built drones. A continent and a century away, deep beneath a cloister in 1885 London, Lydia Hale paused outside a locked archive, rainwater still threading rivulets through the feathering of her bonnet. She felt the iron key pulse warm in her glove, and told herself the sensation was only blood returning to numb fingers. The bells of St. Paul's tolled 11, each note a breath held too long. 1 hour to decide whether the future should be written down at all. In her pocket, the benefactor's last letter lay folded like a verdict. The benefactor himself, no older than 40, ageless all the same, stood at that moment in a paneled study whose address had been struck from every city register since 1847. Gas flame blue danced in his eyes as he inspected a wall map studded with compass rose pins. His right hand, bare except for a pale gold ring, lifted a pin from the mouth of the Thames and pressed it into the heart of Oxford. "Spires," he said to no one, tasting the word, deciding where and when they would crack. And in a lamplit office overlooking the Bodleian Quad, Professor Graham Stowe polished the crystal of a brass pocket watch until the dial's compass engraving caught and returned the glow. A philosopher's brain and a utilitarian's conscience fenced inside his skull. He had warned the order that public spectacle curdled rebel hearts, yet the directive had come anyway, stamped with the wax seal he now worried between thumb and forefinger. 19:30 hours, 15th of October. The note said nothing more, trusted him to deduce the rest. He slipped the watch into its pocket, opened his umbrella, and stepped into the rain as if it were a curtain rising. Five trajectories, five small storms, converging. None of them yet knew the phrase, "Spires Night," though each would breathe it soon. None knew that Lydia's quill, Nora's lecture, Amira's query, Stowe's compromise, and the benefactor's pin all balanced on the same invisible fulcrum. For now, there was only weather. London's steady pour, Boston's dry electric hum, Oxford's chill mist thickening into honest rain. Midnight crept closer, a quiet metronome nobody could silence. In the Radcliffe Square gutter, a single raindrop struck a fallen oak leaf, split, and sent twin beads racing opposite directions. One toward the library's iron drain, the other toward the cobbles outside the locked south gate. A small thing, a choice made by gravity. Beside that gate, a security camera re-angled itself by a single degree, iris widening just enough to capture the instant Nora coasted beneath it, one hand raised to steady the satchel whose contents were not yet extraordinary. Across the ocean, Amira hit enter and watched her screen flood with redactions. Beneath London Stone, Lydia finally slid her key into the lock. Stowe crossed Broad Street without looking back. The benefactor leaned closer to the map, listening for thunder three nights away. When the tower clocks finally tolled 12, the sound seemed to stitch centuries together, a suture of bronze in damp air. Somewhere a door opened, somewhere a query returned, somewhere a prophecy began to write itself faster than ink could dry. And somewhere, though no one felt it yet, the future breathed in, held that breath, and waited. End of prologue. Rain braided itself across the cloister roof like a dark skein, each strand snapping against the gutters before shattering on the cobbles below. Lydia Hale lowered the hood of her oilcloth cloak and stood just inside the archival arcade, water dripping from the brim of her felt hat, pooling at her heels. She waited for the watchman's lantern to vanish around the southern transept. Its yellow pulse briefly painted the nave pillars, then faded, and only then slid the iron key from her chatelaine. It was warm from her body, an improbable comfort in this refrigerated nave, and it turned without protest in the lock. The door sighed inward. Stale vellum and colder stone greeted her, a mingled perfume both sepulchral and exhilarating. She slipped inside, closed the door, and nested the candle between two leather folios. A single match flared, sulfur scratched her nose. When the flame caught, it revealed a long aisle of rough-hewn shelves, each ranked to the ceiling with chained volumes. The air trembled in the candle's slight corona. Beyond that, the world remained a silhouette. Lydia moved efficiently. She knew this room like old prayer, its angles committed to muscle memory from hurried visits over the past month. A white thread, no thicker than a spider's line, still dangled from the third shelf, exactly where she'd left it to mark tonight's target. She slid the volume free, calfskin stiff with age, its spine half-effaced. No title. Perfect. The pew bench at the aisle's end served as her desk. She opened the folio to the sheet she'd pressed flat hours earlier beneath her stove kettle. Tonight's predictions would finish the cycle. Britain's foreign adventurism, the American industrial tilt, a railway disaster in Derbyshire that had not yet occurred. Her quill skated, ink blooming at the nib. Should the monarch cross iron with the syndicates of merchant venture, the isles shall find. She paused, jaw tight. To write the future, no, to consign it, felt like signing another's death warrant. Yet the benefactor's letters were unambiguous, record or be replaced. She dipped the quill again. Find the empire sundered not by saber, but by debt unseen. A draft slipped through the nave and guttered the candle. Lydia shielded the flame with her free hand, knuckles blotched blue from cold. Bells tolled outside. 11, 12, each vibration surfacing through the floorboards into her bones. Midnight was a knife edge, on one side, revelation, on the other, discovery. She would not risk the 13th stroke. Lydia drew a fresh sheet, laid it atop the damp ink, then folded the folio shut. Hot wax from the candle's stump dribbled onto the leather. She pressed her signet, a compass rose, petals dulled by use, into the wax and whispered, "Veiled, yet steadfast." The seal hardened. Another gust bullied the flame. It stretched, wavered, then extinguished, leaving her in darkness, thick as wool. She gathered the folio into her cloak's inner pocket. Somewhere in the hall, a hinge squealed, remote but urgent. Speak. Lydia inhaled a ribbon of wet night air and began to retreat, shawl whispering across stone. The distant hinge settled. Silence reasserted itself. She exhaled, edged toward the exit, and halfway through the doorway, felt the unwritten words claw her conscience. She almost turned back, almost unfurled the folio again to complete the half-sentence. But footsteps slapped the outer cloister. Lydia flattened against the jamb, pulse sounding in her ears with a disconcerting clarity, and forced herself forward into the rain. The folio thumped reassuringly against her ribs. She fled beneath the arches, candle smoke ghosting from her cloak, the final clause of her prophecy hanging, unfinished, somewhere in the dark behind her. Determinism posits that every coin is rigged before it leaves the thumb, Dr. Eleanor Thorne declared, pointer tapping the projector slide. Chance claims the opposite, that our choices, frantic as they feel, tumble freely through the universe. A ripple of cautious laughter ran through the lecture theater. Nora smiled, tight professional, while her scapular muscles knotted. She felt the bruise of the lecture hall lights baking her forehead, the mild sting of chalk dust she hadn't touched in years. A student in the front row, gingham skirt, hair coiled like punctuation, raised a hand. Dr. Thorne, if history is predetermined, why study it at all? Because, Nora answered, pacing the worn teak dais, sensible heels clicking, even prisoners catalog the walls of their cells. Observation is resistance. Besides, if every effect has a cause, uncovering the sequence may grant us a sliver of agency, enough, perhaps, to tilt the outcome. Another ripple, this time thoughtful. She ended exactly on the hour. Tenure committees adored punctuality. Applause fluttered, then notebooks slammed shut. Students poured out, their chatter weaving between the rows like bright streamers. Nora collected her laptop, slid it into a canvas satchel, and rubbed the back of her neck. That pressure, a coiled wire, had haunted her since childhood. Too many collapsing possibilities. Not enough oxygen. Predestination pressed like a thumb against her vertebrae. She swiped her key card at the lecture hall exit. A mechanical clack released the door. Fluorescence flickered awake in the corridor, bathing scuffed linoleum in antiseptic glow. On a sill sat a paper cup bearing Professor Llewellyn's lipstick imprint, caramel latte abandoned at the halfway mark, and beside it, a post-it. Back in 5? The latte had cooled. Condensation ringed the cup like a faint eclipse. Nora's shoes, battered black flats, slapped softly as she threaded the corridors, every motion rehearsed. Past the faculty mail slots, past the framed photograph of Berlin's breached wall, a donation from a retiree who'd claimed to chip mortar himself, toward the library annex. A librarian hummed, "Take on me," under her breath, the synthesized echo at odds with these oak-paneled sanctums. "Evening, Dr. Thorne," the librarian murmured, not missing a beat in the chorus. "Research waits for no one," Nora said, tilting the edge of a smile. She signed the after-hours ledger and accepted the heavy copper key for the rare book's reading room. The librarian flipped to the alto line. "I'll be gone, in a day or two," barely audible. The elevator panged, cables whining. Nora's reflection shimmered in the brushed steel panel, short ink-black hair, glasses sliding southward, worry threading her brow. She pushed the frames up, exhaled. The reading room greeted her with hush and amber lamplight. Beyond the mullioned windows, Merton Street glistened under a persistent drizzle, headlights combing the wet stones. The security camera above the threshold winked, an LED glint. Nora's ID authenticated with a pleasant chirp. She'd intended to review 17th-century sermon pamphlets, dull as unbuttered toast, but a mismatch in the shelving caught her eye. In the D section, where divinity tracts belonged, a squat, untitled box perched like a mislaid suitcase. Library staff prided themselves on exactitude. Such disorder felt obscene. Nora tugged the box down, dust motes wheeling in the lamplight. Brown archival boards, corners reinforced with tarnished brass, no catalog sticker. She settled at the center table, glass desktop cool to her fingertips, and unbuckled the clasp. Inside lay a single folio bound in mottled calfskin, its seal, compass rose impressed upon a puddled disc of brittle wax. A tiny fracture ran through the cardinal points, as if the device had survived some great pressure. She hesitated, breath frosting the glass beneath her nose, then broke the seal with the bone folder kept for map leaves. The crack sounded loud in the hush. Pages fanned open. Copperplate script flowed in rust-brown ink. April 14, 1912, White Star passenger liner meets an iceberg at 41 degree 46 N, 50 degree 14 W. Loss of life to exceed 1,500 souls. She blinked hard. The prediction lurched familiar, notorious. Her rational mind offered coincidences, forgeries, retrospective insertions, but the handwriting, pressure etched into the fibers, belonged unambiguously to the 19th century. Next entry, June 28, 1914. Gavrilo Princip's bullet unthreads Europe. Empires descend like felled oxen. Further down the page, a date she'd taught just hours earlier, November 22, 1963, Dallas motorcade halts, the world with it. Nora's pulse slackened into an uncomfortable crawl. One page after another revealed calamities, some footnoted, others still raw, Chernobyl, September 11th. Each notation bore a clinical precision, latitude, longitude, casualty estimates, margins penciled with cryptic cross-references. Then the ink swerved. Darker. Fresher. 15th October 2023, Oxford's dreaming spires crack beneath a single bolt at 7:30. Evening gala. Casualties. TBD. Tonight was the 12th. 3 days. Her glasses slid. She shoved them back. A tremor rattled her elbow against the desk's edge. Across the hall, the surveillance camera pivoted, just a degree, quiet as a sigh. She sensed motion in her peripheral vision. A coat collar, disappearing behind a stack, the faint rustle of wool. She closed the folio carefully, as though it might explode. A page still protruded. She tucked it more securely, fingers brushing that broken compass. Floorboards murmured. Someone else had entered the annex. Nora darted a glance toward the door. Lamplight spilled into the outer corridor, but the threshold remained empty. She let her palm hover over the folio, debating whether to rebuckle it or cradle it like contraband. Her breath condensed on the glass again, eclipsing her reflection. She wiped it away with the back of her sleeve, heartbeat wagging between her ribs. 3 days. The footsteps stopped just beyond the reading room threshold. Nora forced herself to breathe, slow, shallow, in case sound alone betrayed her. A long second passed, the sort that bends perception. Then the silhouette in the doorway resolved into Professor Graham Stowe. A drizzle-spotted umbrella depended from one hand, its ribs still ticking off droplets, and a faint furrow creased the graying brows above his wire-rimmed spectacles. Dr. Thorne? His baritone was pitched barely above the hush librarians enforce with a single glance. I'm sorry to intrude. The night porter said you were still in the annex, and well, the weather drove me indoors. Nora swallowed the taste of coppery alarm. You nearly got brained with an 18th century folio box, she murmured, easing a palm away from the weapon she had not actually grabbed. Her laugh sounded fragile, a piece of china tapped by a fingernail. You're working late. So it seems. Stowe stepped inside, closing the door with deliberate gentleness. Water mottled the parquet where he planted the umbrella. The committee draft. We both know Llewellyn will ask for revisions before breakfast. He smiled, softening the leonine severity of his features. May I sit? Nora swept a spare chair clear of blotting paper, willed her pulse to throttle down. While Stowe settled, eyes politely downcast, she slid the mysterious calfskin folio back into its box. The brass clasp clicked home. She turned the box so the broken seal faced her, not him. I thought philosophy left you at liberty to drink port before 10 and sleep when convenient, she teased. Rumors, he said. I lecture at 8 tomorrow. Or, rather today, he consulted the gold pocket watch he habitually worried between thumb and middle finger. In a little under 7 hours. The watch's lid bore the same faint compass rose engraving she had noticed once during a departmental reception. Tonight it caught lamplight like a sliver of moon. He set the watch on the table and folded his long fingers. You look troubled, Eleanor. She flinched at the given name. Few colleagues used it. Cataloging error, she said, sliding the box toward her satchel. I need to trace provenance before it goes back on the shelf. Ah. His gaze made a brief, disquieting pivot toward the box. No linger, no greedy flare, just a professional note of interest, the way ornithologists clock a rare wingbeat. I won't pry. Yet he did pry, if politely. He asked who had accessioned the piece, whether she required help with handwriting. Did she intend to carbon date the ink? Each question unspooled with Stowe's trademark courtesy and the low timbre many students labeled BBC bedtime story voice. Nora answered sparingly, fingers on the fluted lid of her coffee-cold thermos. While she spoke, Stowe produced a cotton handkerchief, dabbed residual rain from the frame of his spectacles, and in the motion's shadowed umbrella, lifted his phone. The lens glinted. A silent snap. Click? She thought she heard a digital shutter but could not be sure over the hum of fluorescence. The angle corresponded to where the box rested between them. Her heartbeat spiked. She kept her face neutral, the way tenure-track poker demands. If you'll excuse me, Graham, I should lock this away. Of course. Allow me to accompany you. The quad's slick. He rose, pocket watch reclaimed, umbrella refurled. She would have refused if refusal would not scream anxiety. Instead, she clipped her satchel shut, slid the box inside, and led the way. Their footfalls echoed down the oak-paneled hall. Motion sensors nested in ceiling coves blinked them forward staircase by staircase, each pool of light surrendering to dusk when they passed. At the lobby security desk, Nora keyed the archive return log. Stowe pretended fascination with a bronze of Erasmus, but in the reflection of the glass-topped counter, Nora saw him angle his phone again, thumbnail swiping, reviewing the image he had stolen. She signed out. The guard behind the desk, student-aged, earbuds dangling, passed her umbrella back and waved them into the night. Outside, drizzle grated into honest rain. Stowe tilted his umbrella to cover them both, and they cut across Radcliffe Square beneath the mangled bells of St. Mary's clock. Pavements gleamed. As they reached the portico of the philosophy faculty, he paused. Eleanor, forgive my bluntness, but I sense that manuscript rattled you. The rain pattered like nervous fingernails on nylon. If it concerns academic misconduct, another department's or your own, I hope you know you can trust me. Too many bright careers are sunk by silence. Thank you, she said, but the only misconduct tonight is the archivist who filed a box off by 2 centuries. A lie, half meant to reassure herself. She hugged the satchel strap. Get some sleep, Graham. He offered a courteous nod, but his eyes, steel blue, habitually dispassionate, held a flicker of something warmer. Concern? She could not parse the angle. Rain glazed his silver hair until it darkened, wolfish. Be safe, then. He retreated into the faculty entrance, umbrella shedding droplets, and the door sighed shut. Nora remained under the meager stone awning, pulse still jangled. A gust drove rain sideways. She lifted her collar and set off toward Hollywell Street, where her bicycle waited padlocked to a rack. The satchel bumped her hip. 3 days, she thought, stepping around puddles. 7:30 on the 15th. The lamppost nearest the bike shuddered under wind. She fumbled the lock, got the chain loose, and wheeled into the road's slick hush, spokes glimmering like wet harp strings. At each intersection, she scanned for headlights that felt too slow, too careful. Her studio flat perched above a Turkish kebab shop off Cowley Road, the spicy sweet smell of doner perennially embedded in stair carpet. It was just past 2 when she let herself in. Inside, radiator ticking, fridge hum, ordinary small hour quiet. She bolted the door, laid the folio box on the single burner kitchenette counter, then hesitated. She wanted to reopen it, to confirm she had not hallucinated those final pages, but tiredness clung like wet wool. Instead, she fetched her laptop from an overflowing desk, set it on the narrow bed, and launched a video call. After 3 rings, Amira Shah answered. Pixelated neon braided through the dark shag of her hair, tips cobalt in the laptop glow. She wore a threadbare MIT hoodie, hood up, tie-dye pajama shorts. Spoon halfway to mouth, she blinked at the sudden light. A cereal marshmallow adhered to her lower lip. Nora? Dude, it's, hang on. She checked a phone out of frame. 3:09 a.m. Boston. Somebody die? Maybe 1,500, Nora said. It was sarcasm, but her voice shook. She sat cross-legged. Amira, I need a sanity check. The tenure track already ate your sanity. What happened? Ever hear of something called the Veiled Compass? Amira frowned, spoon forgotten. Is that a LARP thing? Sounds like hipsters in capes. I found a manuscript tonight. Predictions. Like literal prophecies. She summarized in a low rush. Titanic, Princip, Dallas. The entry dated 3 days hence. All in the same hand. 19th century materials, though I can't vouch yet. And the seal is a compass rose. Amira whistled. Someone's elaborate hoax. But okay. Veiled compass. She twisted, set cereal aside, and began typing on a mechanical keyboard that clacked like hailstones. Web search luminesced her face strobily. Let's see. Google nothing. DuckDuck nothing. Dark Archive maybe. She paused, lips pursed. Whoa. An NSA release, partially unredacted last year. Predictive analytics programs. Project name, Compass Veil. Like 5 pages blacked out, except a single line referencing an order from 1926, title, Custodia Rosea. Rose Compass? Maybe coincidence. Nora felt her scalp prickle. Pull the PDF. Already downloading. But N, if this is spook territory, you should not email anything. Air gap or snail mail. Nora angled the webcam so Amira could glimpse the box. I have physical custody. For now. Look, you can overnight it. I'll spectroscopy the ink, but do me a favor. Don't walk around alone with a relic that name-drop nukes Dallas. Nora rubbed her temples. Too late. Stowe already saw the box. He's complicated. The utilitarian guy with the sad puppy eyes? I thought he was a harmless ethics prof. He photographed a page when he thought I wasn't looking. She explained the umbrella, the click. I can't prove it, and accusing him without evidence would toast my departmental prospects. Amira leaned forward, face filling the screen. Then evidence. Tomorrow. Your tomorrow, my later today. Scan the folio. We'll run forensic checks, and maybe call the library security to pull camera footage, see if Professor Creepshots archived his own complicity. Nora cracked a smile. Thank you. Always. Now, if you don't mind, I'm going to drown anxiety in neon sugar. Keep me posted, Dr. Doom. Go to sleep, Shaw. Dreaming is for the wealthy. She winked, ended the call. Nora closed the laptop. Outside the sash window, streetlight haloed each drifting raindrop. 3 days. She slid the folio box beneath her bed, between a pair of storage tubs, then undressed and crawled beneath the duvet in leggings and tee. For a while, she listened to the hiss of tires on wet asphalt, and only when her muscles liquefied into half-sleep did she notice her key, still in the inside lock, trembling minutely, as if teased by a breeze she couldn't feel. She mustered the will to rise, twist it firm, and finally slept. Gaslight burned low, denting the salon's shadows gold. Lydia Hale stood at the edge of conversation, glove fingertips balanced on a stem of chilled wine. Her violin, a Guarneri older than Revolution, rested in its plum velvet case atop the piano. Somewhere beyond French doors, the Thames licked its embankment, polite as a well-mannered dog. The All Souls Winter Salon attracted half of London's avant-garde. Mathematicians fresh from Göttingen, suffragists in unfortunate corsets, a painter rumored to eat nothing but candied violets. Yet tonight, gossip orbited one man, the benefactor, who had not yet arrived. "Miss Hale," drawled Sir Atherton Blythe, leaning to catch her hesitation. His monocle flashed like a coin. "I'm told your new concerto evokes, what was it they said, the violence of prophecy." "If so," she replied, smiling without warmth, "prophecy is an untuned harpsichord one must nevertheless master." He laughed politely, unaware she'd insulted him. A hush striped the room. Conversation sank as though someone had cracked a barometer. The benefactor entered, tall, clean-shaven, eyes the seared blue of a gas flame. He bore no calling card, only a slender ring on his right hand, compass rose rendered in pale gold. Lydia's stomach lurched. She had met him twice before, both times in places where secrecy wore a clerical collar. He inclined his head to the hostess, accepted a single-stringed glass of port, and surveyed the gathering with the poise of one who arranged both furniture and future. A violinist took the small stage, anonymous, dark-haired, playing an andante that feathered the room's unease. Lydia thought she recognized Schumann, though the melody twisted oddly, as though half in reverse. The benefactor approached. "Miss Hale." He didn't bow, he did not need ceremony. "You have the folio." "It is secured," she answered, schooling her face into porcelain. "Tonight I intend only music. Your intention is irrelevant." His voice never rose, yet each word felt bone-pierced with authority. "Deliver it to my courier by dawn." "You promised I would decide when its words were finished." "I promised," he said, "that choice would be given." "A choice expires, like all things." He indicated the violin case. "Play." Her palm itched to slap him. Instead, she obeyed. She took the stage, tucked the guarneri beneath her chin. Gaslight refracted through tear-pricked lashes, bow on strings. She began a largo. The first note climbed, lonely, like a gull over empty ocean. As she played, the benefactor removed a parchment from his coat and with deliberate flourish, folded it into a square. Even while her bow danced, Lydia's mind read what she could of the visible ink. Latitude, longitude, October. She struck a wrong note. The audience did not notice. Most were half-drunk on absinthe figments, but the benefactor did. His smile said, "Hurry." Her bow found the true pitch again. When the last chord sighed out, applause rose, loud enough to mask the single word he mouthed toward her, "Dawn." Gaslight flickered. In it, the compass ring glinted. Nora jolted awake to her phone alarm, 7:05 a.m. She felt grit in her eyes, like sand dredged from a bad dream. Shower, quick, water uncooperative between tepid and glacier. She dressed in charcoal slacks, green cardigan, sneakers still damp from last night, and slung the satchel. An email pinged. Amira, three attachments, the declassified PDF and two image comparisons she'd mocked up between U.S. Army unit insignia and the compass rose. Nora skimmed, flagged for later. She locked the flat, trotted downstairs past the kebab shop's owner coaxing spit coals to life. Morning smelled of raw lamb fat and coriander. Biking had lost appeal. She craved the anonymity of public transit. She cut through Christchurch Meadow to the station, bought an anytime return to London Paddington. The platform coffee kiosk served her a paper cup tasting chiefly of cardboard. When the Great Western train rattled south, she spent the hour scanning last night's pages with her phone, images uploading to an encrypted drive. Each flash garnished curious stares from other commuters. At Paddington, she followed the commuter tide off the train, hem of her cardigan snagging once on a suitcase handle. The vaulted ironwork roof amplified every announcement into iron thunder. She queued at a gray oyster top-up kiosk, fed it a tenner, and watched credits ripple across the screen. Mundane. Reassuringly ordinary. Ahead, a harried father dragged twins toward the Circle Line barriers. One child pointed at Nora's satchel and giggled, "Pirate treasure." She exited to Pred Street, pulled up her collar against London grime, and rode the Bakerloo south two stops, the quick route to the British Library's conservation wing, where a colleague owed her a favor. She texted ahead. In the tube car, two middle-aged tourists studied a graffiti stencil sprayed above the map, a white mask, half-moon eye holes, overlaid with a compass rose. Fresh, edges still glistened. Nora's stomach tightened. By mid-afternoon, she had confirmation on the obvious and contradiction on the vital. The British Library's liaison, Dr. Farzana Malik, hair unbudging under a rainbow scarf, latex gloves impeccable, ran multispectral imaging on a single leaf Nora dared bring. Parchment is genuine 19th. Farzana nudged the monitor so Nora could see fibrous cross-sections lit ultraviolet purple. Ink composition consistent with iron gall popular before synthetic anilines. No modern contamination. But handwriting could have been forged later, copying older ink. Farzana arched an eyebrow. Possible, but professional forgers rarely squander months brewing pre-industrial gall. And pigment migration depth suggests original deposition, not recent. Nora thanked her, rewrapped the leaf, took the district line back to Paddington, nerves thrumming. She tried reading a discarded standard to ground herself, but headlines flitted without meaning. Just before 7, she boarded the return train, day sliding toward dusk outside smeared windows. Amira pinged again. Stowe email address breached, found encrypted outbound at 2:23 GMT. Destination unknown. She attached a screenshot, subject line blank, file name page 1443.jpg. Nora typed with thumbs, he has at least one photo. More later. She arrived Oxford at 8:20, starved, bought a plastic-wrapped falafel roll, almost tasteless. Evening drizzle resumed, cyclists hissed by in reflective gear. Halfway up the stairwell to her flat, she caught the unmistakable nose sting of burnt herb, lavender, but tinged with char. Her door stood ajar. Keys in one trembling hand like a rusted weapon, she nudged. Interior lights off. The corridor fluorescence flickered behind her, interfering with night vision. She inched inside. Kebab shop repairs the boiler, she whispered, a lie to some hypothetical neighbor, then closed the door silently and slid the chain. In that hush, she heard it, a subtle scuff in the living space. She eased the satchel onto the hall rug, flexed cramping fingers, her phone still in hand. She toggled flashlight. Beams swept, sofa cushions spilled, desk drawers gaped, books scattered like birds, startled mid-migration. Folio box gone. No, there, on the sofa arm. Unlatched. Footstep behind. She spun. A figure in black, hooded slim, occupied the kitchenette threshold. Right hand gloved, glint of a ring beneath knitted cuff. Compass motif peeked out in gold. Adrenaline drowned subtle thought. She hurled the flashlight itself. It thwacked the figure's shoulder, satisfying, if ineffective. He or she lunged forward. Instinct flung her sideways, shoulder grazed doorframe, pain sparked. Intruder reached for the box, likely assumption she had removed something vital. He smelled of singed lavender, unnatural and acrid. The ring flashed again, and she glimpsed a crescent scar along the intruder's jaw before they ducked hood deeper. Nora's laptop lay open on the desk. Finnish metal streaming radio she'd forgotten to pause this morning. She slammed the lid down to muffle noise, then grabbed the heavy power brick. Swings. The cord whipped lamps, sent them clattering. The intruder shifted weight with martial grace, swept her ankle. She toppled onto books, breath jarred. Box clattered loose. In the moment they bent for it, Nora seized the stapler, stupid office weapon, and stapled gloved wrist. Metal teeth bit fabric and flesh. A hiss, more irritation than pain. They yanked free, staples pinged across linoleum. Noise above, neighbor's footsteps, curious. The intruder froze. Decision. They darted toward the bathroom window. Nora scrambled after, but by the time she reached the sill, the sash bounced slack. Down in the alley, a blur vaulted a pile of recycling and vanished into sodium gloom. She pressed fist to sternum, scanned apartment. Folio still empty, but the single leaf she'd taken to London must have remained with Farzana. Thank God for compartmentalization. Yet countless other pages, the predictions were gone, maybe photographed, maybe handled, maybe irreparably compromised. Police, she thought. But explaining 19th-century prophecy theft risked psychiatric evaluation. Instead, she locked the window, triple-latched the door, and began methodically photographing what remained. Overturned chair, gloved thumbprint in dust, scorch smell. Evidence, as if any local constable would accept a thesis in metaphysics. Her phone buzzed. Amira again. 2 exclamation marks. She answered on speaker while photographing. Your network cam glitched for 10 minutes, Amira said without greeting. Any chance your flat has interior CCTV? No. Nora steadied her voice. But someone just paid me an unscheduled visit. Compass ring, lavender stench, scar on jaw. Shit, are you okay? I will invoice bruises tomorrow. They didn't steal electronics. They wanted the folio. Which you hid under the bed. It's emptied, she said, throat rough. Pages gone. Silence. Spoon clink in Boston. Then we escalate. Secure location, maybe Cambridge Labs. I can't leave Oxford. The 15th, whatever happens, centers here. Fine, then I'm coming to you. Flights are astronomical on short notice. I have miles and a pathological fear of my immediate surroundings. Email me ASO noises. Also, your doorframe camera picked motion earlier, but feed glitched at the same minute my remote monitor froze. Someone has network spoofing tools. Nora surveyed the devastation. A print of her mother's bookshop, glass cracked, lay face down. She righted it, shook shards into a bin. I'll send you footage of the break-in. Footage of blackouts? Amira snorted. Bundle everything. And Nora? What? Wire your rent tomorrow. Then keep cash on hand. If they compromise banks, paranoid mode on. Nora exhaled. Safe flight. She clicked off. The adrenaline tide ebbed, leaving her muscles watery. She gathered paperwork strewn about, noting omissions. Her request slips from the library. All 8 carbon copies were missing. A siren dopplered down Cowley, unrelated but raw. She fetched antiseptic wipes, cleaned rusted staple blood from the floorboards. The lavender reek clung to her nostrils. At midnight, a knock startled her from repacking. She snagged a chef's knife, approached the door sideways. Yes? It's Jamie from upstairs, love. Heard a rumpus. Nora cracked the door on chain. Jamie wore plaid pajama bottoms and clutched a cricket bat. Saw a bloke scarper down the alley. You good? Fine. Dropped a lamp. He eyed the chain. All right then. Shout if you need anything. The bat thudded downstairs. She closed the door, chest heaving. When finally she thought exhaustion would capsize her, she dragged the sofa against the door. She slept on the floor, knife handle beneath her palm. Dawn blushed weakly behind cloud. She creaked upright, joints protesting. Her phone chimed, delivery notification. She padded to the door, shifted sofa, eased chain. Envelope on mat, no postage. Ink still wet enough to smear under her thumb. The symbol, compass rose, stylized, lines dripping crimson like fresh-cut vein. A single sentence beneath, 7:30, do not interfere. Ink bled downward, gravity bending it into a tiny red tear before her eyes. She stood rooted until the droplet reached the envelope's edge and fell to the floor, a bead quiet as heartbreak. A single red bead wobbled on the lip of the envelope, scarlet, glossy, too much like fresh blood for comfort, and dropped soundlessly to the parquet. Nora stared at the spot as though the droplet might bore straight through the floorboards and keep falling forever. 7:30. Do not interfere. The letters bled outward, ink feathering into the rag-edge paper as if the words themselves were hemorrhaging. She wiped her thumb against her cardigan, then dialed Amira with a hand that wouldn't stay still. Tell me you're holding coffee and not an arterial wound, Amira answered, voice scratchy with airplane PA noise in the background. I've just been served a threat on stationery that's still bleeding, Nora said. Where are you? Gate E12, Logan. My puddle jumper to Worcester's delayed again. 2 coughing toddlers and a man playing Candy Crush without headphones. Fun. You? Cowley rode flat, but not for long. Nora raised the envelope and watched another bead of red fatten at the edge. We need Concord, today. Agreed, the old man's attic. My aunt still keeps a spare key under a cracked flower pot, same as when we were kids memorizing Hawthorne quotes to impress boys who never noticed. A whoosh of static, Amira covering the phone, then boarding. Book the next Heathrow red eye westbound. I'll grab wheels in Boston. Text me the flight number. I'll text you absolution if I make it through TSA. The line clicked dead. Nora tossed the envelope into her kitchen sink, opened the taps, and watched the crimson swirl down the drain until the water ran clear. By 1945, she was wedged into seat 31A of British Airways 13, knees pressed against the magazine pouch, the pillow still smelling faintly of whatever solvent had last sanitized it. The man beside her wore a navy suit, shiny at the elbows, fingernails buffed, briefcase scuffed like it had survived a flood. What drew her pulse's attention wasn't the case, though, but the ring on his right hand. Gold. The compass points so worn, the N and S looked melted into each other. A faint white scar hooked along his jaw toward the ear. He didn't speak. He hardly moved. Only once, when the attendant handed out plastic tumblers of tomato juice, did he acknowledge any living creature, and even then, it was just a nod that seemed choreographed to waste the fewest calories. Nora sipped her own juice, metallic, tepid, and tried to concentrate on the mundane, the rattle of meal carts, the stale, recycled odor of cabin air, the phosphorescent constellations of seatbelt signs. At 38,000 feet, even terror felt abstract, like a philosophical exercise scrawled on a chalkboard she might later erase. She pretended to sleep, hooded eyes half open. The man next to her never reclined, never removed his hand from the briefcase clasp. When the cabin dimmed and most of the passengers surrendered to fitful dozing, she heard him whisper something, four syllables, maybe five, but the engines drowned everything except the cadence, veiled yet steadfast. Her stomach went cold. The same vow Lydia Hale had pressed into wax a century and change ago. She closed her eyes for real after that, but rest came in broken snippets until the captain announced their descent over the shag of New England coastline. Logan, at 2237, smelled of floor wax, overpriced pretzels, and jet-lagged impatience. Amira waited beyond customs, cobalt tips of her hair limp from the humidity, hoodie hood pulled low. She thrust a takeout cup under Nora's nose. Cold brew. Seven times healthier than panic. Nora accepted, grateful for the sting of caffeine. You look like you lost an argument with a toddler. I did. 17 rows of seat kicks. Come on, rental desk is this way. Out at the curb, a November wind needled through both of them. They hurried into a silver Hyundai whose GPS refused to acknowledge that Concord even existed. Every time Amira typed the address, 269 Monument Street, the old manse, the screen jittered, maps resetting to Boston Common. Blacked out memory locations, Amira muttered. Cute. She unplugged the dash cable, hot-spotted her phone, and fed coordinates directly to a routing app she'd built two grad school spring breaks ago. The map recalculated, obedient. Traffic thinned once they left I-93 for Route 2. Oak leaves chased the asphalt in erratic arabesques. Roadside pumpkins sat half-collapsed on porch steps, grinning rot. Nora rubbed fog off her window and felt the tug of childhood. She had bicycled these same back roads on summer visits to her aunt, convinced that if she pedaled fast enough, Emerson himself might stride from the trees to offer a revision of her eighth-grade poems. 11:42 p.m. The Hyundai's tires crackled over gravel as Amira nosed it down the narrow lane running behind the old manse. The house loomed, windows black, clapboards silvered by centuries. Bursts of moonlight punched through branches, striping the facade like jail bars. Amira killed the engine. Keys still under the flower pot? Thoreau said tradition is just peer pressure from dead relatives. Nora retrieved the pot. It cracked further in her hand, and pried loose the tarnished spare. Inside, the entry smelled of dormant dust and faint turpentine. They kept flashlights low, skimming the wide plank floors. With each step, Boards offered a long, tired complaint, as though objecting to wakefulness at this hour. To the left, the parlor fireplace still held ashes gray as cobweb. Straight ahead, the narrow stairs spiraled toward the attic. Squirrels skitter overhead, tiny claws scrambling across rafters. Amira took the lead, laptop bag slung crosswise. Nora followed, one hand tracing the banister worn smooth by generations of hopeful pilgrims. The attic trapdoor protested but yielded. Dust motes erupted in the flashlight beams, swirling like startled fireflies. The space smelled of cedar shingles and rodent musk. Stacked trunks, mildewed quilts, bundles of yellowing newspapers lay in patient disarray. Above, a single narrow window framed the Concord River, black and motionless under the moon. "The cipher from Lydia's salon diary," Amira whispered. "NECR, northeast corner, under Riverside Eve." They crouched, crawled across joists, and located a small brass-bound chest no larger than a shoebox. A single rusted staple kept the lid closed. Nora worried it loose with a Swiss Army key and lifted the lid. Inside, parchment wrapped in oilskin. 16 folio leaves, compass wax seals intact but brittle. She exhaled shakily. Each sheet's ink looked older than Cumberland Farms coffee, but the dates marched right up to 2099. Blank after that. A void on the final page. "We tag and bag," Amira said, slipping nitrile gloves on. She peeled her laptop out, connected a fold-flat scanner pad, and began capturing images rapid-fire. Each page flashed, beep, slid into an anti-static sleeve. Nora held them gingerly, elbows locked so her hands would not tremble. Halfway through, floorboards downstairs moaned, heavier than any squirrel. The women froze. Another creak closer to the stairwell. "Time to abort." Amira slid the unscanned folios back into the chest, locked what she could. Nora killed both flashlights simultaneously. Darkness swallowed the attic, only moonwash outlined shapes. Footsteps ascended, slow, deliberate. Nora smelled lavender, scorched, chemical. She eased her phone out, thumb finding silent mode, and texted, "Attic intruder. 2? Amira curled fingers around a wooden croquet mallet abandoned in a corner. The silhouette emerged through the hatch, a lean figure, hood up, compass ring winking, the same white scar. Briefcase in one gloved hand. He spotted them, two dim forms crouched among relics, and lunged. Amira swung. Mallet caught his forearm, a grunt escaped him, low and guttural. He dropped the briefcase, but his other hand snapped forward, catching Nora's wrist in a lock that ignited her nerves. She stomped his instep. He barely flinched, twisting away with inhuman efficiency, pulling her toward the stairwell. Amira shouted, "Duck!" and hurled the mallet. Nora folded, the mallet whizzed overhead and thudded somewhere useless. Nora clawed the folio packet from her pocket, the one she'd slipped there without telling Amira, and jammed it down the neckline of her shirt. If he wanted it, he'd have to choke her. Instead, he shoved her aside, grabbed the chest, and vaulted for the stairs. Amira chased, laptop under one arm, swearing in Bengali and English both. Nora staggered up, heart hammering, and followed, vision quivering at the edges. The night outside had turned colder. The intruder sprinted across the yard, chest tucked under one arm like a quarterback protecting a football. He dove into the driver's seat of a matte black Ford Explorer parked nose out along the lane. Engine barked alive. Amira and Nora piled into the Hyundai. Seatbelts clicked. Amira jammed the key. Engine coughed once. Caught. "Hold on," she muttered, fingers already spidering across the dashboard tablet she'd jury-rigged to her phone. "I'm jacking the local traffic grid. Concord lights still run on outdated Siemens boxes. Might buy us seconds." They fishtailed onto Monument Street. Ahead, the Explorer's taillight streaked like flares through leaf litter. Amira floored it. Speedometer climbed past 50 in a 30 zone. Oak branches overhead thrashed in their own alarm. At the first crossroads, the Explorer blew a red. Amira's tablet chimed, she'd flipped all signals on the cross street to green. No intervening traffic. Good. On they flew, tires hissing over damp asphalt. Radio activated when Amira's elbow jostled the console. Patsy Cline warbled crazy, her voice syrupy and incongruous amid pursuit. Nora's laugh escaped, brittle. Heads up, Amira said. Rotary ahead. Explorer braked late, fishtailed but shot through. Amira yanked the wheel, Hyundai tilting dangerously, tires screeching. Gravity shoved Nora against the door. She tasted iron as her teeth cut lip. The road narrowed, stone walls hemming pastureland. Wind erupted through a cracked seal in the rear window, sounding like distant screams. Can't let him reach Route 2, Amira breathed. Bridge, Nora warned. Old North Bridge, single lane, wooden deck slick with frost. Explorer swerved onto it. Boards groaned under its weight. Amira punched keys one-handed. The bridge's historical trust kept a remote security gate, usually never lowered. Tonight, it slammed down like a guillotine, just as the Explorer cleared. Hyundai skidded to a halt yards from iron bars. Explorer vanished beyond Riverbend, folio chest hostage. Damn! Amira pounded the wheel. We tag, but we didn't bag. Nora unclenched her fingers and felt stickiness, her own blood and something else, a scrap of parchment protruding from her cardigan cuff where she'd tucked it. She eased it free, one line of fresh ink shimmered silver in moonlight. 15 OCT 2023, Oxford, Spires Fracture, Casualties TBD. Different penmanship from Lydia's. The letters looked hastier, angrier. New hand, she whispered. What? Amira killed the engine. Patsy Cline Warble died mid-note. They're still writing predictions, Mira. Someone's updating the manuscript in real time. That means the Order isn't just preserving the past. They're drafting the damn future. Which means Oxford isn't inevitable. Nora folded the scrap, pocketed it. We can intervene. Better plan fast. Chest's gone. Guy's probably en route to a safe house. Walden Woods, Nora said. Sermon pamphlet margins, remember? Lydia's cipher kept citing Walden. Maybe a dead drop. Amira stared toward the tree line, thinking, we'll need daylight, and rest, and maybe gasoline. Nora's limbs quaked now that adrenaline had quit. There's a park service campsite half a mile back. Fire rings, no ranger this late. We should lay low. Amira nodded, turned the Hyundai around, and idled it up the slope to a clearing ringed by pine. They parked under pitch pines that smelled of sap and old summers. Nora gathered fallen branches while Amira kindled a small blaze with a fire starter pill she kept for tailgate cookouts. Flames fluttered up, casting their faces in bronze wavering planes. Silence settled. Only the crackle, the hush of distant traffic, an owl's single interrogative hoot. Amira rubbed her temples hard enough to whiten knuckles. Tell me we're not in over our heads, Thorne. As headless as Marie Antoinette. Nora added a slim log, sparks spiraling skyward. I hacked the state grid to reroute signals. If Commonwealth IT traces it back, I'm toast. Commonwealth IT can't trace a footstep to its own socks. Nora tried a smile. It faltered, but the Order might. Amira stared into flames. When I was 9, my dad took me crappy fishing here. We fried the fish over a fire just like this. I told myself I'd live in a cabin one day. No routers, no passwords. But tonight, I'm grateful for a Wi-Fi hotspot and a dirty sedan. Nora watched Ember's pulse. Emerson would approve of conflicting desires. He called consistency the hobgoblin of small minds. Amira snorted. You quoting dead men is how we got here. Maybe. Nora hugged knees to chest. But dead men keep leaving us breadcrumbs. We're obliged to follow. The fire settled into coals. They unrolled space blankets from the trunk, the foil crinkling like distant thunder, and dozed in shifts. Whenever Nora's turn at watch arrived, she scanned treeline for the white-scarred operative, half expecting him to materialize between columns of pine, ring gleaming like a wolf's eye. But only wind moved. Morning. Pewter sky, breath misting. They doused the embers, buried ashes. In daylight, the old North Bridge gate stood padlocked, no sign of the explorer's tire tracks on the frosted grass beyond. They drove into Concord proper, Main Street with its colonial storefronts, the bookstore Nora's mother had idolized, a cafe selling $5 poured-over righteousness, and used Amira's laptop to pull DOT traffic cams. The explorer had exited toward Bedford minutes after crossing the bridge, then vanished, plates unreadable. At noon, they sat in a booth at Helen's restaurant, omelets congealing, while Nora flipped through scanned images on Amira's screen. One page froze her fork halfway to her mouth. November 22, 1963. Dallas Motorcade. Lydia's Pen. October 24, 1929. Wall Street. Lydia's Pen. August 6, 1945. Hiroshima. Lydia's Pen. And now, October 15, 2023. Oxford. Spires Fracture. Casualties TBD. Different Hand. Angular Strokes. Ink almost black. We have 3 days, Nora whispered. 72 hours, Amira corrected. Plenty for miracles. Or disasters. Same difference. They ordered coffees to go, paper cups soft as insults, and walked the Minuteman trail for privacy. When they reached a bench overlooking Walden's tree-shaded water, Nora handed Amira the lone page she'd salvaged. Amira scanned and uploaded it through a secure tunnel. Cloud redundancies engaged, Amira said. At least they can't vanish that. Nora tried to inhale the lake's damp earth smell, to ground herself. Instead, she smelled phantom lavender. They'll come for us. Then let's not be here. I'm going back to Oxford tonight. Everything converges there. The folio started there. You? Beside you, obviously. Somebody's got to keep your Wi-Fi alive. She nudged Nora's shoulder. Red eye eastbound, lands Heathrow 07 Gur. We'll beat rush hour. Nora managed gratitude in a curve of lips. Pack snacks. I've sworn off airline tomato juice. Logan once more, this time hush of late afternoon. Security confiscated Amira's multi-tool, but not her sarcasm. They boarded Iberia Codeshare 4276, backs and shoulders already protesting a second crossing in 24 hours. A teenage boy in the row behind hummed Patsy Cline off-key until his guardian made him stop. Nora spent an hour cataloging ordinary sounds, the crinkle of pretzel packets, pages riffling in a thriller paperback, a flight attendant's heels clicking 45 paces between galley and lavatory, until she convinced herself that the world still contained banality. Amira, laptop perched on tray, ran pattern analysis on the angular handwriting. Matches early 20th century Bureau of Engraving script. Could be Stowe imitating. Nora frowned. Graham? He's a scholar, not a forger. Scholarship hasn't kept plenty of villains from villainy. Nora conceded the point by burrowing into her blanket and watching Iceland's volcanic coast slide beneath them like a live-edge cutting board. Sleep came shallow. Dream. Lydia, in the All Souls Salon, violin tucked under chin, bow arm trembling. Instead of sheet music, a single line of prophecy stretched across the stand, 7:30. Lydia sobbed while she played, and the tear became a crimson bead that fell, just as the envelopes had, splattering onto Nora's dream shoes. She woke to cabin lights cycling through dawn pink. Laundress. Arrived on Trent Minutes. Heathrow Terminal 5 smelled of cinnamon buns, jet fuel, and disinfectant. Queue for UK border snaked like socially distanced doom. Nora bounced on heels, pockets heavier than they had any right to be. Oilskin packet tucked inside her blazer, another 3 folio leaves sealed inside a travel-size shampoo bottle, the salvaged scrap folded beneath her phone case. Next. A customs officer waved them forward. His badge read, G. Kiropoulos. He wore a faint 5 o'clock shadow and an expression that suggested Shakespeare's complete works in eye rolls alone. Business or pleasure? Academic conference, Nora answered, presenting passport, letterhead printout. Her voice felt two octaves off. And you? The officer asked Amira. Same. Cyber ethics panel. He scanned their documents, thumbed through pages. You declared any reading material over 150 years old? Nora's nervous laugh came out strangled. No antiques. His eyes flicked up, skeptical, uninterested, both. Stamp thunked on each passport. Mind your pockets, he said, returning them. Things tend to go missing in crowds. They stepped aside. Fluorescent lights buzzed overhead, too bright after cabin dim. Nora looked back. Officer Karopoulos had bent to scratch his ankle. Around his right thumb glinted a plain gold ring, faint compass embossing worn almost smooth. She swallowed. We're being watched already. Amira zipped her hoodie, lips thin but determined. Good. Saves us the trouble of introducing ourselves. They shouldered backpacks and merged into the river of arrivals, manuscript pages rustling invisibly against Nora's ribs, a secret heartbeat, urgent and brash, counting down to 7:30. The passport officer's rubber stamp came down with a grudging thud, but the gesture did nothing to relieve the snarl of arriving passengers already choking the arrivals hall. Nora lifted her carry-on, took 3 apologetic steps to the side, and immediately had to stop again. Dozens of suitcases clotted around the carousel, the rubber belt shuddering forward an inch, then clacking to a halt. Above the din, a public address voice mispronounced somebody's precious surname for the 3rd time. Amira peered between shoulders. Not seeing my rucksack. Yours? Nora shook her head. The motion dislodged a lock of hair. She tucked it behind her ear, nails digging harder than she meant to into the strap of her canvas satchel. The oilskin packet inside felt heavier than any textbook she had ever assigned. A child nearby howled that his Pokemon stickers were trapped in the black hole. The belt lurched, spat out 2 dented hardshell cases, then froze again. Airport staff in high-vis vests converged, poked at a jammed panel, declared a temporary operational pause, and vanished behind a service door that hissed shut like a stage curtain. Amira sighed. 72 hours to an historical cataclysm, and the universe wants a comic bit about lost luggage. She fished a sour lime disc from her hoodie pocket, cracked it between molars. You good? Fine, Nora answered, voice calm, thumb half-mooning the soft flesh of her palm until it burned. Just a bag. Except the satchel. Except the 3 folio leaves tucked inside her blazer lining. Except 7:30 and the bleed-red envelope and the man with the compass ring who might be, at this very moment, a single cue away. Another family arrived, perfume and fatigue radiating off them in equal measure. Nora angled her body to keep the satchel inboard, away from careless elbows. 20 minutes later, a frazzled supervisor re-emerged, announced the belt had eaten a stray handle, and the jam broke. Amira's rucksack appeared, its rainbow paracord zipper pulls intact. Nora's small wheeled case never did. She filled out the clipboard, brand, color, contents, while the supervisor nodded with the glazed sympathy reserved for lost luggage forms and terminal illnesses. It will find you, love. They always do, he said, though his eyes betrayed serious doubt. Nora forced a thank you, shouldered the satchel yet again, and followed Amira out through the sliding doors into the arrivals hall's aggressive fluorescence. Outside, the queue for the Heathrow Express ticket machine stretched 6 deep. Nora tried contactless. The reader sulked, flashed a cryptic error. She jabbed buttons with increasing impatience until Amira rapped knuckles against the metal casing. Breathe, she murmured. Nora inhaled. 4 steps ahead. Radcliffe by 9, Stowe at 10. Worst case we cab to Paddington, Amira said, already waving at a driver. The cab smelled of stale air freshener and someone's forgotten chips. Windshield wipers flogged the glass as the M40 unspooled westward. Nora traced beads of rain racing each other down the window, every drop distorting the sodium glow of motorway lamps into trembling halos. "You're bruising that strap," Amira said quietly. Nora looked down. Her knuckles were ivory, half-moons of skin pushed up around her nails. She exhaled, loosened her grip, flexed stinging fingers. "I know." "He'll want the pages," Amira went on. "Probably thinks he deserves them." Nora considered Professor Graham Stowe, the respectful way he asked permission before borrowing chalk, the deliberate pause before each reply, as though rehearsing civility, and that flash of something unreadable the moment he glimpsed the folio box. "Half loyalty," the benefactor had said in Lydia's entry. "Half. Which half?" Rain intensified, drumming an arrhythmic tattoo on the roof. Amira flicked on the radio. News about rail strikes, ministerial resignations, a record low October barometer reading. Storm fronts stacking like bad debts over southern England. "Convenient," Amira muttered. "Foot traffic unlikely, cameras streaked with rain." "Oxford likes its omens visible," Nora said. "Ah." By 8:30, they were trundling through Cornmarket in a minicab no larger than a domestic fridge. Bicycles whipped past, tires hissing on wet flagstones, their LED strobes painting spokes on the mist. The car deposited them at Broad Street, and they hurried beneath the Gate of Humility, past whooping undergraduates celebrating something that required no celebration, toward their temporary hideout. A windowless postgraduate office, Amira had once jokingly christened the Crypt. Amira keyed them in. The place smelled of dry erase fumes and instant ramen, but the aged desktop PC offered a stable Ethernet line, and crucially, nobody expected a historian and a hacker to share a cubicle after hours during Michaelmas. Nora peeled off rain-slick jacket, rolled up her sleeves. Her forearms goose-pimpled in the draft from an elderly ventilation grate. "We've 40 minutes before Stowe." Amira fired up the scanner, fed in the newly acquired pages. Each soft whir felt obscenely loud in the building's after-hours hush. Alternate sheets revealed diagrams, a stylized crown splintering into shards, a bell mid-fracture, latitude-longitude pairs. Nothing overtly addressed Spire's Night, but a marginal note, cramped and slanted, repeated the phrase twice beside the date, 15 OCT. When scans reached the cloud vault, Amira encrypted, re-encrypted, and forwarded copies to three wholly legal but blissfully inattentive archive servers. The room's single fluorescent tube buzzed overhead like an irritated wasp. "You look pale," Amira said. "I look informed," Nora answered. The digital clock on the CPU tower ticked to 21:42. Time. Amira zipped two earpieces into a mint tin, pocketed it. "You sure about walking in alone? I could ghost the entrance cameras, tail you inside." "And if Stowe's testing me?" Amira conceded with a nod. "Text every 10. Nora shouldered the satchel. Fingertips brushed the zip where the oilskin packet hid. The weight seemed to rearrange her spine, forcing shoulders back. Outside, wind lashed high street banners so they snapped like miniature sails. Radcliffe Square squatted ahead, its cobbles slick as oiled slate. Floodlights on the camera made the rotunda appear buoyant, a limestone lantern adrift on black water. A lone figure waited under the portico. Stowe's tweed appeared darker in the rain, almost charcoal. Only his silver hair held its usual clarity, haloed by the uplight. He leaned on a brass rail, hand lingering there as though the metal were both anchor and confession. "Eleanor," he greeted, inclining his head. "Professor." She stopped short of the steps. Rain peppered her glasses. She wiped them with a coat cuff, buying one breath, then another. Her voice, when she found it, emerged steady. "You said urgency." "Indeed." He produced a key card, swiped the ancient wooden door. Modern beep, centuries-old oak. "Shall we?" They descended into a foyer whose vaulted ceiling funneled every footfall into cathedral echoes. Stowe led her along a corridor to a staff reading lounge, empty save two green baize tables and the persistent drip of a leak somewhere overhead. No sooner had the door shut than Stowe opened his umbrella, an odd habit indoors, let the last droplets fall into a waste bin, and set it aside with near-ritual care. He removed his pocket watch, thumb circling the compass rose etched on the case. "I presume you still have the manuscripts," Nora pictured the oilskin. "Only fragments now." "A pity." He closed the watch with a click. "The order acted rashly, taking them from your flat. Fear breeds clumsiness." His tone suggested mild regret rather than apology. "You don't deny affiliation." He lifted both palms. "We are all affiliated, in ways, some unknowingly." She swallowed, nails again bit into flesh behind her thumbnail. "Then what is Spire's night, and why 7:30? He considered her for 3 beats. Somewhere above, wind rattled a sash window. A long, resonant shudder traveled down the wall. "Tell me first what you believe it to be." "I believe someone intends to stage a disaster at the Bodleian fundraising gala," she said. "Capitalize on a gathering of donors, faculty, perhaps even the Chancellor. Strike the heart of Oxford while eyes are on champagne flutes." Stowe's expression flickered. Admiration? Or distress? "That is certainly one reading." "Not yours?" He walked to a bookcase, fingers trailing spines. "Spire's Night predates your folio by more than a century. Originally, it denoted any engineered correction. When organic randomness threatened the long arc, the order inserted its own chaos, small, self-contained, to avoid greater ruin." "Utilitarian triage," Nora said. "Precisely." He faced her fully now. "Tell me, Eleanor, if a single lightning strike could prevent a war, would you reroute the cloud?" The question reminded her of her own lecture. "Prisoners cataloging cell walls," she shook her head. "I'd rather smash the compass you're using to aim the storm." Stowe exhaled through his nose, almost a laugh, almost sadness. "You underestimate the storm's appetite. The gala is unavoidable. It can be postponed." "History will compensate," he countered. "Delay buys nobody safety, it purchases uncertainty." His hand tightened on a chair back, knuckles blanching. "But uncertainty frightens the order more than bloodshed." Rain drummed harder. Beyond the window, lightning capered across low clouds, though thunder lagged far behind, as if reluctant. Stowe stepped closer, voice lowered. "I can't change the directive. I can adjust parameters." He produced a folded sheet, plain printer paper, and slid it across the table. Nora kept her hands still. "I saw you photograph a page," she said. "2 nights ago. He didn't deny it. Because you hesitated to trust me. And why should I now?" "Because I'm offering you proof." His hand rested on the back of the chair, grip easing. "Open it." She unfolded the sheet. It contained a diagram of the Bodleian's upper reading room. Exits, service corridors, guttering system, storm drains. A single red X marked a lead glass panel, almost 2 stories above the main floor. "Glass spire?" she guessed. "Q," Stowe said. "At 1930, that panel will shatter outward, giving the effect of an explosive bolt from above. The lightning itself is theater. Induction coils wired to the roof, powered by generators tucked into a fake catering truck." "Who dies?" He hesitated, the first true hesitation she'd seen tonight. "Ideally, no one, but the shrapnel vector intersects the dice. Donors, senior faculty. And you want me to steer them clear?" "I want you to bear witness," he corrected. "Intervention must be recorded to maintain narrative continuity." Nora laughed once, ugly, brittle. "Make me historian of your staged carnage? No. Then at least accept the earpiece. If things deviate, I'll guide you." She pocketed the diagram but left the earpiece on the table. "Tell the order I'm no one's marionette." Stowe gathered the umbrella. At the door he paused, fingers resting on the brass handle, a farewell caress. "You have 48 hours. Decide what you're willing to save." He left without looking back. Rain eased to drizzle. Nora stepped into Radcliffe Square and inhaled petrichor tinged with warm stone. Bicycle chains clicked past. She texted Amira, "Meet Library Quad now," then strode toward the lamplit outline of the quad. Amira emerged from behind a stack of recycling bins, hood up. That was quick. Not quick enough. Nora handed over the diagram, voice low. "Lightning illusions, tempered glass, donors in the kill zone." Amira's eyes raced across the blueprint. "Generators need line of sight to avoid voltage bleed. Roof access is key." She produced the mint tin, popped it, two-way comms, sub-gigahertz. 18-hour battery. Not fancy, but good range inside stone walls. Nora accepted a bud reluctantly, seating it. Plastic felt foreign in her ear. "We'll need staff clearance." "I've started forging badges, digital overlay with the gala's branding." Amira tapped her phone. "But we're visible. The order will watch the guest list." Nora considered. "Then we volunteer as stagehands. No list, just night of labor." Amira grinned. "Nobody checks the help." A gust scuttled papers on High Street as they marched toward her college office. Bells tolled 10:30, each note suspended in damp air longer than physics should allow. Nora unlocked the side door, disarmed the alarm. Inside, the corridor lights were motion-sensing. They woke as the women advanced, then blinked out behind, leaving a moving tunnel of glow. In her office, Nora spread the scans across the desk. One phrase kept snagging her eye. A, mask, page 6. Amira scanned, found the right page, zoomed. The cramped marginal note read, "Masquerade 1885, Spires Night Rehearsal, Violin Cue Sforzando." "At least they like music cues," Amira said. The phrase triggered a memory already half her own. Lydia Hale in a candlelit salon, violin trembling. As if summoned, the scene unfurled inside Nora's skull. Gas sconces hissed. Muslin gowns rustled like restless birds. Masks obscured even familiar faces. Lydia's own mask, black domino, trimmed silver, restricted each breath. Somewhere in the throng, the benefactor watched, though she couldn't locate him among the wheeling colors. A steward wrapped a staff. Musicians lifted violins. Lydia counted silently. 1, 2, and mad notes exploded into the room, more percussive than melodic, the sforzando marking. It cut across conversations like a saber, and the chandelier above reverberated. A second later, a bubble of glass high in the ceiling shattered, expelling not lightning, but an avalanche of golden confetti. Shrieks, laughter, applause. The guests thought it mere spectacle, unaware the stunt calibrated weight and trajectory for some future night when glass, not foil, would fall. Lydia's bow quivered mid-stroke. The benefactor, unmasked at last, smiled from behind a potted palm, his compass rose ring winking. She understood then, the rehearsal was successful. The real thing would follow, somewhere else, some other year, once calculations matured. Nora snapped back to the office, heart pounding. "Flashback," Amira asked. More like a warning. Nora massaged her temples. "They've done this before. Exact blueprint. 1885 All Souls. Maybe smaller scale. Tonight is the perfected iteration." Amira adjusted the lamp so rain-streaked window glass reflected the two women side by side. "Then we monkey-wrench perfection." Morning arrived smeared and tentative. Nora managed 2 hours sleep on her office sofa, head pillowed on the satchel. When sunlight finally eked through, she gathered her hair in a stubby knot, washed her face at the faculty restroom sink, and convened with Amira over scalding kettle coffee. At 9, they presented themselves to the gala's logistics desk, a makeshift station in the Sheldonian foyer. Nora wore dark trousers, black polo, no university crest. Amira favored cargo pants, tool belt, an expression equal parts earnest and bored. "Audio tech shift," she told the undergrad volunteer checking names. "We were last-minute additions from media services." Volunteer scanned her sheet, chaos of highlights and scribbles, then shrugged. "Sure, sign here, and here's your badges." Just like that, they were in. Nora clipped hers to her belt, heart stuttering. one step inside the belly of calculation. The day blurred into cables, lighting trusses, test sweeps. Violins rehearsed snippets of Vivaldi and Corelli while catering staff argued over tablecloth folds. Nora spent the hours mapping exits, two public, three staff, one freight lift. She counted tiles between dice and leaded glass window, 12. Calculated shrapnel risk radius, 8 meters. She texted Stowe, positions confirmed, evacuation plan possible, then felt dirty for even that concession. He responded within a minute, grateful. Shepard, do not martyr. She almost hurled the phone. Instead, she typed, I am not your shepherd. Read receipt pinged, no reply. Outside, clouds bruised purple, wind buffeted Bodleian walls until the pigeon deterrent wires sang. The scent of wet parchment seeped through ventilation ducts. At 1700, thunder rumbled, a baritone clearing its throat. Nora found Amira backstage, coiling XLR cables. Storm rolling. I looped the generator feed through a dummy breaker, Amira said. If they try to spike voltage, breaker trips, no show. Not a perfect fix, could still cause sparks, but we avoid glass rain. Nora touched her friend's elbow. You're astonishing. Tell my mother. Amira offered a tight smile. Crowds arriving. Tuxes everywhere. Bells outside tolled the quarter hour. Nora slipped to a staff restroom, locked the door, replaced her polo with a plain black blazer to blend among waitstaff. She pinned the earpiece, tucked loose strands behind ears, whispered, check. Amira's voice fizzed softly, loud and clear, positioning in tech pit, hot mics in 5. Backstage corridor smelled of fresh paint and a trace of machine oil. Nora walked it slowly, counting breaths, shoes squeaking faintly. At the junction ahead, 2 men in catering whites blocked the path, backs broad, hair too neatly clipped for temps. Their posture straightened when they saw her. Right-hand man wore a plain gold ring. She nodded, kept moving. They let her pass but turned almost immediately, whispering. Earpiece crackled. 2 possible hostiles behind you, Amira said. Continue straight, exit left stair, maintenance corridor. I'll meet you topside. Nora obeyed. At the far end, she scanned badge at a metal door that opened into a narrow service stair, smelling of bleach and dust. She trotted down a half flight, found herself in a corridor so tight her shoulder brushed conduit. Pipes overhead clanged as the building exhaled. Above, muffled strings tuned to A4. The gala's overture, Handel, maybe, swelled, found her through floorboards. She pressed deeper into the maintenance passage, slipped behind a stack of folding chairs, and crouched. From here, she could hear, through a vent, applause greeting some dignitary. Her phone buzzed. Stowe. She stared at the screen before answering strictly via text. In position. He replied, remember, 1930 window. She didn't type back. Instead, nails pressed half-moon crescents into her palm, while her other hand found the sealed oilskin packet. In 42 minutes, the dreaming spires would either crack or stand. Rain hammered the roof vents. Light dimmed as clouds stuffed themselves against the glass. Nora settled her breathing, heart knocking like an impatient archivist demanding entry, and waited for whatever history would do next. The filament bulbs in the service corridor flickered once, twice, then steadied. Nora pressed her back to the chill plaster, tugging at the thin black ribbon that held her half-mask in place. The string had ridden up during her hurried change, sawing the tender skin beneath her cheekbone. She loosened it 3 millimeters, just enough to breathe, then wiped damp palms against the seams of her borrowed waitstaff jacket. 29 minutes to curtain. From the rotunda above came the first liquid sweep of violins, a brushed velvet phrase that hung in the rafters before resolving into polite chords. Handel, she guessed, over-familiar, like silver that's been polished to the point of anonymity. Her earpiece crackled. Level's good, Amira whispered. Background chatter, stagehands, lighting cues ghosted through her line. Storm resistance surge tested. Breaker'll trip on a 15-amp spike. Copy, Nora answered. She straightened, cradling a tray loaded with crystal flutes. Ginger ale, not champagne, because real champagne might tempt someone on the clock. The door in front of her creaked open, as though the building itself had taken a shallow, pained breath. A rush of golden light spilled across the threshold, smelling of beeswax, wet stone, and the faint caramel tang of torched demerara sugar drifting from the dessert station. Nora stepped through. The upper reading room of the Bodleian had been transformed into a masquerade worthy of high Victorian melodrama. Drapes of midnight velvet fell between the limestone arches. Above them, metal trusses held programmable LEDs that sampled the storm outside and echoed each lightning flash in softened lavender and marine. Hundreds of guests moved beneath the canopy of borrowed color, silk gowns, starched lapels, every second face hidden behind a domino or Venetian half-mask. Compass roses, subtle and otherwise, adorned cufflinks, brooches, even the sugarwork perched atop the Gâteau Saint-Honoré. Nora threaded the throng like a tide-borne fragment of dark cloth, careful to keep her satchel-less waist unobtrusive. She distributed glasses, took empties, noted egress points, the main staircase at her 12, the west foyer at 3, the fire door hidden behind a silk partition at 9. Sprinkler heads blinked red standby LEDs above those entrances. Amira's breaker box sat one level up, behind a hinged panel labeled Lighting Feed B. She counted, 35 meters from dais to glass panel, 12 again to the freight lift. Her shoulder still ached from the Boston chase, muscles pinching each time she extended her arm, but adrenaline and the icy fizz of ginger ale vapor kept the pain distant. Across the room she spotted Stowe. He wore evening tails of an older cut, broad lapels, a gray silk waistcoat, and no mask, as if daring recognition to test him. Donners drifted toward him the way iron filings cuddle a magnet. His pocket watch appeared, vanished, appeared again, every consultation a tick against her pulse. When their eyes met, he inclined his head, a host acknowledging discreet staff presence. She felt her throat tighten around words she wouldn't speak. Lightning forked outside. A camera flash magnified a thousandfold. Simultaneously, the house system dimmed to half lumen, an intentional cue so that the musician's sudden forte could bloom. Lydia's bow arm once marked just such a moment, Nora thought, and that recognition slid her sideways in time. Gas jets hissed like snakes underfoot, and the walls of the Albion Club pulsed in amber. Lydia Hale, domino mask askew, felt the tremor in her wrist as the conductor chopped the air, sforzando. Her Guarneri shrieked the note. It was supposed to mimic rapture, but it felt like a warning, a rappel line thrown across a century. Nora, Amira's voice yanked her back. South stair. Two men in cat suits, like actual tight blacks, not caterers, heading roof ward with a silver flight case. Mark. Nora pivoted, following a tributary of partygoers toward the south stair. She passed a dessert cart swarming with strawberry millefeuille. The chef completed one final flambé, and the sugar scorched, releasing a scent like burnt carnival candy, sweetness gone slightly acrid. The men Amira flagged were halfway up the iron spiral. They moved with practiced economy, neither speaking nor looking down. The silver case bore a laser-etched compass, its cardinal points filled with matte enamel. Heat climbed Nora's neck. "See them," she muttered, moving to intercept. She lifted her tray shoulder high, as if offering service, and stepped onto the spiral. Guests noticed the silver case, but mistook it for tech, photography gear perhaps, and politely turned aside. On step number 11, the lead man glanced back. Eyes behind neoprene goggles widened at the sight of a waitress in pursuit, then narrowed. He shoved the case at his partner and reversed down two steps, blocking Nora's way. "Staff only," he said. Mid-Atlantic accent, clipped. "So am I," she answered, tilting the tray just enough that ginger ale sloshed perilously close to the rim. "Event director wants that case cleared by 1930. He took in the mask, the badge. "No director." He reached for the tray. She let him take it, deliberately, His hands were now full. She shot past on the left, jamming herself between his elbow and the spiral's center column. A clatter. A glass shattered on the tread and sprayed carbonated sugar across his trousers. By the time he balanced again, she had gained 4 steps. The partner, still burdened with the case, blocked her path near the top landing. "Trade?" she said lightly, tugging the ribbon of her mask free. "You get my pretty disguise, I get the hardware?" He answered with a downward shove. The case smashed into her shoulder, the world flashed white hot. She grappled his wrist, pivoted, and used physics, a hip throw she only half remembered from a self-defense workshop. He stumbled, knees unlocking, and slid 3 steps before slamming onto the deck. The case flew loose. Metal hit stone with a bell-like clang and popped open. Induction coils, copper loops, paired with a battery pack the size of a paving slab. A polymer-sealed instruction sheet fluttered free. Shatterglass, release charge, it read in plain English, capped with the compass insignia. Earpiece sizzled. "Breaker showing load spike. That you're doing?" Amira asked. "Not yet," Nora rasped, snatching the instruction sheet, cramming it down the front of her jacket. She kicked the battery pack toward the stairwell edge, too heavy to lift, then sprinted up the last short flight and onto the catwalk above the reading room ceiling. A metal grid underfoot vibrated with each drumbeat from the band below. On her left yawned the leaded glass that was meant to shatter outward. The panel's rivets glowed faint orange, heating elements primed to blow. She dropped to her knees, hands hovering, mind racing. If she could delaminate the fuse route, footsteps approached fast. The partner in neoprene goggles, limping but upright, dragged the battery by its carry strap. Lightning flickered again. Nora snatched a CO2 extinguisher he must have passed earlier and yanked the pin. The hiss roared louder than applause. Supercooled fog engulfed coil and battery, smothering heat sensors. He cursed, swinging the battery like a mace. She ducked, extinguisher nozzle catching his jaw, reopening the pale scar she'd glimpsed in Boston. Blood beaded black in the low light. 1930, he growled, hauling the battery into place. A glance at her watch, 1928. She snapped the nozzle again. He deflected with an elbow and drove his shoulder into her torso. The blow hurt but jarred him more than her. The extinguisher cylinder scraped a stanchion and skittered away. She seized the loosened mask ribbon, looped it round his neck, twisted. He elbowed her side, but his leverage eroded, knee, throat, battery strap tangling. Below, the band hit the downbeat of a gavotte. Guests applauded between movements. The tension of simultaneous realities nearly split her skull. She pivoted, shoved. He lost footing on foamed deck plating, fell backward against the panel. Glass spidered but held, 1929. Nora released the ribbon, grabbed the induction coil's 2 primary leads, and ripped. Sparks the color of struck flint crackled. Battery alarms chirped. She hurled the severed array over the catwalk edge and heard it clatter on pipes 3 meters below. The operative snarled, wordless, and lunged again. She was quicker now, adrenaline pure. A palm heel to the nose, his goggles cracked, lens popping. He reeled, lifted a hand blindly, and in that heartbeat, the backup timer in the battery unit crossed its fail-safe threshold. An electrical whump burst. Low frequency, like a mutant bass drum, and every chandelier wobbled. But the coil was no longer seated, so the discharge arced sideways, up through service ducting, harmless but spectacular. Below, house lights strobed red, sprinklers coughed, a few candles guttered. Glass above their heads stayed intact. The panel's fracture line glowed bright orange, then faded. The attempt had failed, but the room, suddenly half dark and hissing with water droplets, could not know the difference. Fire alarm bells bellowed, distorted cellos scraping the lower registers. Nora shoved past the stunned operative. She heard him curse her ancestry in a mixture of languages as she pelted down the opposite stair. Water from sprinklers misted the steps, made leather soles unreliable. At step 5, she slipped, hard, bruising her hip against iron. Step 6, she regained balance. Earpiece rattled. Breaker tripped. You all right? And why does it smell like kettle corn in here? Glass intact. Discharge misfired. We need evac now. Copy. Security pushing crowd west exit, I'll cover east. Background. Someone hacking a lung, Amira's smoker's cough triggered by adrenaline and aerosols. Meet by loading bay. When Nora reached floor level, the crowd swirled, masks askew, frills drenched. Servants and donors alike jostled. One dessert cart had overturned, spilling cannoli into a lagoon of custard and brandy. Burners beneath the chafing dishes sputtered, singeing spilled sugar to a brown char that smelled like carnival funnel cakes left too long on iron. Near the dais, a woman in emerald silk lay on her side, thigh slashed where someone's glass had burst. A white-gloved footman pressed napkins to stanch the bleeding. Nora vaulted a low rope, knelt. "Press steady higher," she instructed. "I'll fetch compresses." She tore linen from a nearby table, returned. The woman moaned, mascara tracking a tributary down one temple. A ripple in her peripheral, stow. He stood 30 feet away, umbrella repurposed as a cane, lips parted. Some internal argument played across the mobile planes of his face. Go, stay, intervene, obey. Then his eyes dropped to the compass watch. One beat. Two. Without looking up, he snapped it shut, turned, and faded into drifting emergency lights. Nora shouted. He did not break stride. Stow walking, she breathed into the calm. Which exit? South, maybe side corridor. I lost sight. Help casualty triage. But triage teams in high-vis jackets had flooded in. She relinquished the wounded woman to actual medics and hurried east. Smoke slipped from a junction box that had caught the stray arc. Sirens dopplered closer outside. Through stone mullions, Nora glimpsed blue lights bouncing off the wet quad. Rain still hammered overhead, so loud it might as well have been inside with them. Amira, pale, drenched, materialized, oxygen mask fogging with each breath. Blackout zones cleared, she rasped, voice muffled by the plastic cup. We gotta move before they seal the perimeter. They retraced steps through the service tunnel. Twice uniformed security yelled, demanded ID. Amira flashed her forged passes, muttered, PA system critical in a tone of official urgency, and they were waved past. Outside, the quad looked like an overturned jewelry box, silver puddles, shards of half-lit glass, guests huddling under borrowed coats. Press crews had assembled with astonishing speed, camera booms craned, a medic intercepted. You, ma'am, you're bleeding. Nora glanced down, crimson soaked the sleeve of her black blazer. She couldn't pinpoint when she'd been cut, maybe shattered flute stem, maybe the catwalk scuffle, but the slick felt warm despite the chill rain. Ambulance, the medic ordered. Now, she tried to wave him off, saw his stubborn set face, and relented. Amira attempted to follow but coughed so violently she doubled over. Get her treated, Nora urged the medic, nodding toward Amira. Severe smoke exposure. Minutes blurred. The hiss of doors, plastic stretcher smacking metal rails, saline dampening gauze. Nora's view narrowed to ceiling rivets inside the ambulance, each one vibrating with siren oscillation. An oxygen mask descended. She pushed it aside. Not lungs, she slurred. Arm. Precaution, the paramedic insisted. The mask smelled of antiseptic and reclaimed air. It fogged and cleared, an erratic metronome that reminded her of Lydia's hesitant bow strokes during that long-ago rehearsal. In the Albion Club, the masquerade turned frantic. A scholar in a harlequin mask clutched his abdomen where confetti had sliced skin like razors. No, that couldn't be. Confetti is harmless. And Lydia saw the benefactor remove one petal from his lapel, weigh it as though it were metal, not paper. At A&E, they deposited Nora under fluorescent brutality, triage clipboard balanced on her knees. A nurse named Devika cut the sleeve, irrigated a gash 4 inches long. Deep, she said, but misses the muscle belly. Stitches followed, the thread tugging through skin like wire through raw canvas. Nora clenched her jaw until temples throbbed. Across curtained bay partitions came Amira's voice, muffled but recognizably sarcastic. If I expire, delete my browser history. A respiratory therapist laughed. Good sign. Stowe drifted into her cubicle, rainwater stippling the shoulders of his overcoat. He leaned on the frame, hair limp and uncombed for the first time she had seen. His eyes found the sutured wound, slid to the IV pole, then finally to her face. Chaos, he said softly. Yet catastrophic freefall avoided. Tell that to the woman bleeding on the parquet, Nora shot back. He flinched, almost imperceptibly. I misjudged the redundancy. His hand strayed to the watch chain. The watch itself was absent. I intended minimal harm. You hesitated, she accused. Why? The hospital's air exchange hum filled the silence. Then, I saw a child, he replied, not answering. Standing near the dais, unmasked. Could have been an undergrad volunteer, could have been your doing. It broke the pattern. I needed new variables. He straightened slightly. Your intervention, effective. Let's not toast to success, Nora said. I still have shards of your folly in my arm. He glanced toward the partition where Amira's hacking cough echoed. Your friend? Breathing. In spite of you. A crackdown of thunder rattled window blinds, as though celestial gavel had struck. Stowe pocketed a nervous hand. They will come for you now with less restraint. I'm counting on them, she said. Another beat of undecided words hovered, then dispersed. He gave a slight bow, the shadow of old-world courtesy, and disappeared down the corridor. The automatic doors sighed behind him. Devika returned with discharge paperwork. You've refused overnight observation, she noted. That's unwise. History doesn't pause for bed rest, Nora muttered, signing where indicated. An orderly wheeled Amira in, still fogging her oxygen mask. Her eyes, though reddened, glittered with mischief. Guess whose improvised voltage log fried the order's grid nodes? She waggled a USB drive between glove-pale fingers. Nora tried to smile. The stitches pulled, turned it into a half-grimace. That's my girl. Discharge required signatures, disclaimers, a tetanus booster. By the time they left, rain had abated to sullen drizzle. The car park sodium lamps reflected pools of guilt on asphalt. Ambulance crews traded weary jokes near the bay doors. Press vans idled at the security perimeter, long lenses lurking like herons. Amira tucked the oxygen mask into her tote, a souvenir, and said, "We can't go back to your flat. Orders probably tailing every known address." "I know a sub-basement under Exeter College," Nora answered. "Archivists call it the catacombs. Original ventilation shaft still dry even when the Thames bursts." She wrapped her damaged arm in a borrowed cardigan, then helped Amira hobble across puddles. The world smelled of wet leaves baked under sodium heat. Every exhale hung like speech bubbles in the chilled air. Catacomb access hid behind a scaffolding drape where stonemasons had been repointing medieval blocks. Nora, key to padlock, combination still the birth date of the first archivist to die of asbestos, and wrestled a corroded door inward. Cold drafts greeted them, edged with old lime, ancient damp. Inside, stone steps spiraled down into gloom. Her shoes, still soaked from the quad, squelched on the first landing. Rainwater seeped through the mesh of her trainers, numbing toes. Amira clicked a headlamp, the LED casting an anemic cone that barely dented the dark. Nora breathed through the smell. Earth, mold, a faint ozone memory of tonight's near strike. "Congratulations," Amira whispered. "You're now the only lecturer I know who moonlights in subterranean archaeology." "Temporary," Nora said. "But the Order won't expect a return to Rudyard Kipling's mortar joints." They settled in an alcove where mortar had crumbled into powder, but the bricks held. Nora lowered herself onto a cold stone bench, arm throbbing. High above, the city exhaled distant sirens and the occasional clatter of closing shutters. Down here, only the rhythmic plink of condensation echoed. Amira unpacked the USB, her laptop, a handful of prescription inhalers. She took one puff, offered a second. Nora declined. At length, Nora drew the folded instruction sheet from her jacket, smoothed it against lamplight. The compass seal at the top was embossed with fresh wax, an operational directive issued within the last 48 hours. In the margin, handwritten in rapid strokes, if primary fails, move to Selene. Do not let the chronicler slip. Selene, Amira murmured, reading over her shoulder. That's new. Might be the Selene vault, Nora said, recalling an apocryphal archive rumored to lie even deeper than these catacombs, a repository for items the Bodleian wouldn't publicly claim. Or a code name for whoever's directing field ops. Amira typed, cross-referencing. Selene appears twice in Lydia's manuscripts, once as Vault of Moonlit Tomorrows, once as Nightbound Reliquary, but coordinates blank. A shiver coursed Nora's spine. She peeled back her sleeve bandage, inspected the stitched cut. Rough, but functional. Then that's where they took the stolen chest. And where they'll regroup, Amira finished, her fingers paused on the keys. We go after it, don't we? Wind found a crack in the stairwell above, made a fluted moan. Nora shifted, shoes squelching again. Yes, she said at last. But daylight will make the search easier. For now, the Order thinks we're either hospitalized or corralled by police interviews. How's your headspace? Nora considered the question, the subterranean hush, the thickening sense of inevitability pressing the air. Stitched, she replied. And stubborn. Amira smiled behind chapped lips. Good, because the grid nodes I fried, they'll reboot by dawn. We have maybe 6 hours before they trace the failure back to tonight's breakers. Then we study. Nora produced the oilskin packet, unfolded 3 leaves with reverent caution. She laid them across Amira's keyboard light. Let's see what tomorrow thinks it knows. The ink and the black-lit screen tinted each other in varying hues of sorrow. Outside, Oxford's dreaming spires, unfractured for now, caught the first uncertain glimmer of moon between bruised clouds. Water slid off gutters above ground, drained through forgotten conduits, and pooled cold in Nora's shoes. She barely noticed. Her mind had already descended farther than the catacombs, into a vault of contingencies where choice might still outrun prophecy. The pages waited, silent as graves, daring her to keep reading. Thank you for choosing A Story Publishing.